Gamma's hold on reality could be when he ran out of meds, and issuing orders to a Spartan III in the throes of a psychotic break was not a task she cared to undertake. It had been tricky enough for Fred 104, who'd had the armor and size of a Spartan II to put behind his commands. Veda preferred to rely on prevention, which was why she insisted that her team be given the longer-lasting subcutaneous inserts, even if they did require a minor operation each time they needed to be changed out. Veda gestured at the dead keepers. "Let's secure those bodies and close up the ship." "Strip the weapons first," Mark said. He removed a Jiral Hanai-sized pistol from the chieftain's equipment belt. Known informally as a Mauler, the revolver had a ferocious-looking blade beneath the trigger housing and was loaded with superheated bolts that fragmented like buckshot when fired. Mark spun the cylinder to make sure it was carrying a full load of 5 bolts, then looked up and finally seemed to realize he sounded like he was the one giving orders. "Just a suggestion, of course. But we're going to need weapons." Veda glanced at the collection of corpses lying beneath the stolen faith. "You three are weapons," she said. "But point taken. I'll search. Ash will keep watch. You and Livy stow the bodies." The Gammas responded simultaneously. "Affirmative." "And stay out of the cargo hold," Veda added. "No taking chances with the Austanilus." The trio exchanged looks of exasperation, and Olivia said, "Yeah, Mom, we kinda figured." Olivia and Mark each took one of the chieftain's arms and dragged him out of a pool of purplish blood. Anyone coming near the stolen faith would undoubtedly notice the carnage and the streaks leading toward the boarding ramp, but removing the bodies would at least reduce the likelihood of the bloodshed being noticed from a distance. Veda searched the rest of the dead, collecting not only an assortment of small arms, but Shag's datapad, several chronometers, and 3 Keeper comm headsets. The process took only a minute, but Mark and Olivia were tossing the last Kigyar onto the ramp even as she removed his chest holster and plasma pistol. Olivia pressed a control pad on the hull, and the boarding ramp's servo motors began to whine and growl beneath the extra load. Veda feared she'd have to send someone to carry the bodies into the hold. Then Mark stepped to the end of the ramp and began to lift. The servo motors settled into a purr, and the ramp rose so rapidly that Olivia had to dodge back and forth beneath it, jumping up to push arms and legs back into place as the corpses slid into the cargo hold. Finally, the ramp thumped shut. Veda exhaled in relief, then distributed the weapons and knelt with Ash behind the stolen faith's nose strut. The spaceport sat in the bottom of what appeared to be a huge, sheer-walled crater. The expanse of green pavement stretched more than a kilometer to a ring of yellow cliffs that encircled the entire facility. Overhead, there was no sign of an energy barrier or any other atmospheric containment device, only a mauve radiance cast by the swirling gas bands of the planet Pedoran. The stolen faith had landed in a quiet area to one side of the spaceport, close enough to the cliff that Veda could see its vitreous surface was permeated by tiers of artificial grottos. Half a kilometer to her left sat a fleet of light attack vessels, scattered in front of a provisioning station. To the right, the cliff wall was only 70 meters away, with a single unmarked Reap X Turaco standing on 3 struts in front of it. Veda was relieved to see that the Turaco's boarding ramp was raised and its dorsal cannon turret pointed at its own tail, but she didn't know what to make of its presence. With a bulbous flight deck and an ovoid body tapering to tail packed with long-range sensor packages, Turacos were a new style of experimental reconnaissance boat that the UNSC had begun testing only a couple of months before. Like most other vessels developed by ONI's Reverse Engineering and Prototyping Xenotechnology Department, Reap X Turacos were top-secret test craft with a production run measured in the dozens, so it was hard to believe the Keepers had already captured one. Veda turned to Ash. "Threat assessment?" "Still nothing immediate." "Good," Veda said. "Any attention from that Turaco?" "Negative. It looks buttoned up." Ash gestured to the left, toward the fleet of attack vessels a half kilometer away. "I'd say that provisioning apron is our most likely source of a chance discovery." The apron was bustling with service carts and maintenance crews, but the workers appeared so focused on their tasks and on avoiding accidents that no one seemed to be looking the stolen faith's direction. Veda estimated about 50 vessels ranging in size from gunboats to corvettes, and it appeared obvious that the little fleet was being prepared for launch. "Seems like the keepers bought your story about the banished coming," Mark said, coming up beside Veda. "Nice bluff." "Except for one thing," Olivia said, also joining them. "Their Dokkob thinks we're captured pirates, and he's expecting Shag to bring us to him real soon."
"And when we don't show up," Ash said, "it'll take him about 2 minutes to guess our mission."
"Affirmative." Mark checked the battery pack in the plasma pistol Veda had taken off one of the Kigyar, then said, "We're going to need more firepower. A lot more."
"Slow down," Veda said. "First, we need a plan."
Mark frowned. "We don't have time to start planning," he said. "I say we find the Tuas, grab them, and get out before the keepers have a chance to react. Our plans have a way of going sideways lately."
"Maybe," Veda admitted. "But sideways is better than backwards. Or dead."
She checked the data pad she had recovered from Shag and saw that the time was only 14:47. The stolen faith had emerged from slipspace around 0800, which was when the slip beacon would have transmitted its tracking signal, and Blue Team's jump from Venezia would take about 12 hours total. "The Silent Joe won't arrive for another 5 hours," Veda said, "which means we can't expect Blue Team support until 2015, at the earliest."
"So?" Mark asked. "So that's a long time to hold out against overwhelming odds," Veda said. Assuming the Tuas were actually on Terram, Veda had no doubts about recovering them. Her gammas were just that good. But getting everyone off the moon alive was another matter. "We're going to need to delay, evade, or escape. Maybe all three, and that takes planning."
"Don't forget divert," Mark added. "If we can make the keepers think they're already under attack, that will buy us some time."
"What it'll buy us is mission failure," Olivia said. "We can't spend 5 hours blowing things up. We'd never last that long. Not in civvies."
"Come on, Mark," Ash said. "You know that." Mark sighed.
"Yeah, I guess so," he said. "It's just that I miss the armor, you know?"
"Who doesn't?" Olivia said. "But remember what Chief Mendez always said. Armor's no substitute for brains," Mark finished.
"Yeah, I remember."
"Smart guy, that Mendez." Veda thought for a moment, assessing their options, then said, "Okay, our first job is to locate the Tuas, and it would be good to do that before the keepers realize we've escaped."
"Over there," Mark said, pointing to the right. "But we'll have to be careful. There'll be guards."
At first, Veda thought Mark was indicating the Turaco, but then she saw that he was pointing past the vessel's nose, at the artificial grottos in the cliff face. All of the openings were narrow and arciform, but they varied in height from around 2 meters to as much as 4, and many were tilted on their axis in a pattern that seemed distinctly repetitive. She could see nothing but darkness beyond the openings. Certainly no reason to believe that they would find either the Tuas or guards inside any of them.
"Why there?" Veda asked.
"Because if the Tuas are here, they're probably being held in a detention center," Mark said. "And prisoner transports berth near the detention center."
Veda nodded. "Makes sense."
There was no need to ask what Mark meant by prisoner transport. The chieftain had made it pretty clear that he considered Veda and her team captives.
"Good thinking."
"Second that," Olivia said. "You can be pretty smart when you're not trying to start a firefight."
"Firefights take brains, too."
"All the same, let's keep a low profile until Blue Team arrives." Veda took a moment to look around and make sure there were no threats developing on their perimeter, then said, "5 hours, guys. I need some ideas." The ferrets rattled off a dozen good suggestions, and 2 minutes later they had a solid plan. Veda wasn't sure it would work, but there was a chance. And the one thing she knew about her gammas was that when they were given a chance, they put it to good use.
"Okay. Reactivate Team Com," Veda said.
The reception dot in her ear popped live, and she heard a trio of click patterns confirming the rest of the team's comm units went active as well.
The Gammas removed the various rings, studs, and bolts still decorating their faces, and passed them to Ash, along with Olivia's knife and one of the comm headsets Veda had recovered from the Keeper corpses. She gave the second headset to Olivia, and donned the last one herself. The earpiece covered the same ear containing her reception dot, so at times she would be listening to two comm nets at once. It wouldn't be a problem. Like most good detectives, she had developed a knack for eavesdropping on several conversations at once. Veda exchanged the M6 pistol she had recovered from Shag for the Mauler that Mark had taken off the Chieftain, then asked, "Everybody clear on their assignments?" The three Gammas confirmed in unison. "Then let's do this," she said. "And be careful." "I don't want anyone taking unnecessary—" "Mom," they said, nearly in unison. Ash opened a small cut on his forearm and set off alone toward the back of the spaceport, laying a false trail they hoped would lead any searchers in the wrong direction. With a headset clipped over his ear and a spiker resting casually over his shoulder, he looked like a human keeper on an errand, and Veda did not think he was likely to attract any undue scrutiny from a distance. Olivia returned to the control panel next to the stolen Faith's boarding ramp, and began to enter a string of commands that would allow her to rewrite the ship's security routines and seal it tight, at least in theory. During her ferret training, Olivia had been taught everything Oni knew about hacking Covenant computers. A necessary precaution, since the ferret's role as undercover operatives would often make it dangerous to carry a team AI around. But this would be the first time she had tested her skills in the field, and there was no telling what kind of modifications a Kig-Yar crew might have made to a Sang-Healy starsloop. Mark tucked his knife and pistol into his belt at the small of his back. He crossed his wrists as though they were still bound, then set off toward the cliff on a vector that would take them close to the Turaco. Veda pointed the Mauler at his back and followed a few steps behind, as though she were escorting him to the detention center. She had her doubts about whether they would be able to bluff their way past the entry guards, but it was worth a try. As they passed behind the Turaco, the steady tick of a cooling hull grew audible, and Veda could feel heat radiating off the thrust nozzles. Recent arrival, she noted. The detention center intake could be crowded. "Which means the guards will be busy with someone else," Mark said over his shoulder. "That's always good." "But having to drop extra targets isn't," Veda said. "We need to do this quietly, remember?" "No worries," Mark said. "It'll be quiet. A Turaco only carries 8 people." As soon as they were past the Turaco, Mark began to angle toward an opening to their left. Veda saw nothing special to suggest it was the entrance to the detention center. It was about 3 meters high, and like all of the grottos ringing the spaceport, it had the shape of a narrow arch. There was no hint of light spilling into the interior, as though its mouth were covered by a dark curtain, or an opaque barrier field. Veda was about to ask about the direction change when she noticed that Mark's head was tipped slightly forward. She looked down and realized he was tracking the occupants of the Turaco, following a barely perceptible trail that seemed little more than a dark ripple a few centimeters beneath the spaceport's green pavement. She glanced behind her and saw that their own footsteps were creating a similar effect, leaving pale ripples of shadow wherever they trod. "Good eye, Mark," she said. "Have you run across this kind of surface before?" "Not this stuff exactly," Mark said, "but hard light is pretty versatile. The Forerunners used it in a lot of different ways." Forerunners. Veda's stomach sank. The last time she had set foot in a Forerunner ruin, she had become involved in 3-way battle for possession of an ancient AI, and ended up having to flee her homeworld. "Please don't tell me this was a Forerunner base."
"Maybe not a base," Ash said over TeamCom, "but it was a Forerunner something. The Keepers don't have hard light technology, and there's no way they built their own vacuum energy extractor."
"They have an extractor?"
Veda did not know quantum theory well enough to understand the fundamental nature of vacuum energy. It had something to do with virtual particles blinking in and out of existence. But she did know that vacuum energy permeated the entire universe, and that the Forerunners had harnessed it to create a nearly infinite power source.
Are you sure?
Sure enough, Mark said. It takes a lot of artificial gravity to hold an atmosphere over an area this size. And I don't see any other power sources big enough for the job. Do you?
No.
Veda was not about to press the point. Mark and the rest of her gammas had fought inside 3 Forerunner installations that she knew of. So they were certainly the experts on the team.
How much will this complicate our mission?
Mark shrugged.
Not enough to stop us.
They were only a dozen paces from the mouth of the grotto, so Veda fell silent and tried to convince herself that Mark's nonchalance was warranted. After all, the Keepers still worshipped Forerunners as their deities, and the Forerunners had once inhabited the Shap's system. Finding Keepers operating from a Forerunner ruin on Terram was probably no more surprising than finding a band of human pirates operating from the ruins of one of Saturn's lost moon colonies. The air grew humid and began to smell of algae, and the sound of lapping water rose behind her. Veda glanced back to discover that the unmarked Tarako and the stolen Faith now stood in a vast blue-green lake. Waves were breaking around the vessel's struts and splashing up on their bellies, but the craft appeared steady and in no danger of sinking. Across the way, on the provisioning apron, the Keeper's fleet of light attack vessels was barely visible, a distant flock of cockpit canopies and weapons turrets sitting just above the wave crests. But the surface beneath Veda's feet seemed as solid as ever. She dropped her gaze and found herself standing on water, perhaps half a meter above a pebbly lake bottom. Her boots began to darken with dampness, and her socks began to feel wet. Mark was already stepping into the grotto, so there was no time to remark on the lake's sudden appearance. But Veda's only training had included a survey of human encounters with Forerunner technology, and she knew their extra-dimensional engineering capabilities could make reality seem all too fluid. Mark vanished into the darkness as though he had passed through a curtain, and Veda felt her gut clench. The Yoni course had described unfathomable perils. Stasis pods that suspended occupants in time. Slipspace bubbles that concealed whole worlds inside melon-sized spheres. So she had good reason to be nervous. Entering now, Veda said over team comm. The portal is covered by some sort of blackout field, so we may lose contact. A pair of acknowledging tongue clicks sounded over her ear dot. But only 2. She tightened her grip on the Mauler and followed Mark through the blackout field into a large vestibule, with walls of glassy yellow stone, illuminated by a bright amber light with no clear source. The chamber had high, graceful lines and sharp angles that hinted of inconceivable wonders around every corner. And as she continued to look around, she began to experience a growing sense of calmness and belonging. Mark stood to her left, one hand tucked behind his back to grasp the hilt of the combat knife tucked into his belt. Directly ahead, a utilitarian reception counter stood between 2 narrow staircases that spiraled down from opposite directions. Behind the counter, a set of metal weapons lockers stood in the mouth of a high, triangular corridor leading deeper into the grotto. There were no guards in sight. In fact, there was no sign of anyone at all. Mark signaled Veda to clear the staircase on the right, then drew his combat knife and began to creep up the one on the left. As usual, he moved with the swiftness and silence of a ghost. Veda ascended along the inner curve of her staircase, moving more slowly but just as quietly. It seemed strange for a Forerunner installation to utilize stairs rather than an anti-gravity lift, but there was an aura of tranquility about the place that made her suspect it had not been built for pragmatic purposes, that it had been some kind of spiritual retreat. And with a 5-meter ceiling and a rise of 40 centimeters between each step, the staircase was certainly Forerunner scale. Veda had ascended a dozen steps when Mark's whisper sounded in her ear. Clear to the next floor. Veda leaned around the curve of the wall and saw nothing but empty stairs ascending past an archway, opening onto the next level. She sprang up the last few steps as quietly as she could, then dropped to her belly and peered down a long curving corridor. The right side was lined by a row of shimmering energy barriers, each covering the entrance to what Veda assumed to be a detention cell. On the wall next to each barrier hung a power conduit and generator pod. She saw no sign of guards or the Turaco crew. Clear on this side, too. Veda began to crawl back down the stairs and felt dampness beneath her palm. She ran her hand over the step below and found more. But someone came this way recently. What do you have? Veda hesitated. Did you see the lake? Hard to miss, Mark said. My feet are wet. So were somebody else's, Veda whispered. Most likely the Turaco's crew, unless the guards stepped out to meet them. Any sign of the guards? Unclear, Veda said. All I have is damp stone. Understood. Mark paused, then said, This doesn't make sense. There should always be a guard at the intake counter. You'd think. Veda returned to her feet and began to descend back down to the reception vestibule. The last thing she wanted to do was get trapped upstairs by a returning guard. We'd better locate them before we go on. Affirmative, Mark said. Veda listened for an acknowledging click from Ash or Olivia, but heard none, which suggested the energy field across the entrance was blocking their TeamCom transmissions. Just another joy of operating within a Forerunner installation. As Veda descended into the vestibule, a liquid murmur sounded beyond the entrance, and she glanced outside to see that the lake had quieted considerably. The waves that had been lapping against the cliff face a few minutes earlier had calmed to mere ripples. The water beneath the unmarked Turaco was now so still, it reflected the vessel's belly. And as she gazed out on it, she began to feel her mind expanding out across it, stretching toward the infinite. Veda drew her attention back to the lake, focused on her team. Olivia and Ash were nowhere in sight. Ash had probably passed from view already, but Olivia should have been standing beneath the Turaco by now. The new plan called for her to hack its security systems and take control of the craft, then hold possession until the Tuwas were recovered and the rest of the team joined her. Once everyone was aboard, they would move to a secure location somewhere in the Pedoran planetary system, and remain hidden until the Silent Joe arrived with Blue Team. But Mark was right. Their plans kept damn well going sideways. Veda studied the struts beneath the Turaco and the stolen Faith, looking in vain for movement or a hint of human silhouette, then finally had to accept that Olivia could not be seen. Veda was about to slip outside and attempt comm contact when a gentle clang sounded behind the intake counter. She spun around to find Mark standing in front of an open weapons locker, his combat knife in one hand and a buckled door in the other. Too loud, I know, he whispered, but I'm telling you, we need more firepower. He sheathed his knife and reached into the locker with both hands, then removed a pair of BR-85 battle rifles. Both weapons were equipped with sound dampeners and sentinel sights. I'm starting to agree, Veda said. She braced a hand on the intake counter and vaulted over, nearly slipping on a patch of damp stone. I didn't see Livy out there. Mark's head snapped around. Something happened to her? That's not what I said. Veda unloaded the Mauler and set it in the bottom of the weapons locker. But she should be at the Turaco by now, and I didn't see her. Mark handed her a battle rifle. Doesn't mean she's not there. Mark, she's wearing black Ralex, not SPI. Veda loaded the BR-85, then began to fill her pockets with spare magazines. If she was out there, I'd have seen her. And we're out of communication, Mark said. It's more than that, Veda said. Mark, does this place make you feel kind of tranquil? Affirmative, he said, and I don't trust it. It could put us off our guard. Right, Veda said. I'll try to stay nervous. Mark closed the weapons locker. Good idea, he said, but not about Livy. She might be out of communication, but you've got to trust her. You've got to trust all of us. I do, Veda said. It wasn't her team she didn't trust. It was her own lack of experience. But that doesn't mean I don't worry. Would it help, Mom, if I told you to stop? Not in the slightest.
Veda dropped to her haunches, then turned her head sideways and looked along the floor. A trail of dampness ran down the corridor leading out of the intake area.
You notice this water?
Mark's eyes widened. He motioned Veda to follow, then advanced along the corridor wall and into a nearby chamber so vast, it almost seemed they had passed outside. Overhead, an emerald dome speckled with blue stars soared higher than they could see. Below, stone terraces descended in concentric rings toward a pit so deep and bottomless, it seemed to swallow light itself.
What the hell is this place?
Veda whispered.
Weird,
Mark said. He dropped onto the next terrace and placed his face next to the stone.
And I don't think this is water.
Veda turned in the direction he was looking, and 10 meters to the left, saw a line of dark droplets running over the terrace edge. She joined him and saw 3 fan-shaped blood spray patterns on the next level down, then finally understood why there was nobody at the intake counter.
The guards were executed,
Veda said. She hopped down onto the terrace with the spray patterns, then peered over the edge and saw 3 bodies, 2 humans and a Kigyar, lying on the level below.
And since the Chiraco is still out there, the shooters must still be in here.
Mark stepped to her side and studied the carnage for a moment, his expression equal parts dismay and bafflement. Perhaps he was feeling the same odd pang of loss that Veda was, a sense that she had somehow been hurt by the murder of the 3 keepers, that her own soul had been diminished by their deaths. The Forerunner Grotto was an eerie place, she decided, and not one where she cared to remain any longer than necessary. She turned from the bodies and tipped her head back toward the vestibule.
That way, she said. Upstairs.
Chapter 9 2005 hours, December 13th, 2553, Military Calendar. Unidentified Turaco, Salvation Base, Moon Terum, Pedoran Planetary System, Shaps System. A distant clang sounded from somewhere outside the Turaco, and Olivia shifted her attention to the security feed above the cramped engineering station. The screen had been divided into 4 quadrants, none of them showing the stolen faith, which was most likely the source of the noise.
Keep that Muddawat star sloop on screen, Olivia said. Don't make me tell you again.
Would that be a threat?
The AI called herself Argy, and she had been a steady source of frustration since Olivia used an Oni override code to board the Turaco.
Because you don't have that authority.
I do now. Olivia reached down beside her knees and raised the 2 switch guards on the cabinet face. If I can bypass ship's security, I can handle a system restore.
And wipe the log data you've been trying to access,
Argy countered.
You wouldn't do that.
Olivia shrugged.
Sure I would, she said.
You have me locked out anyway, and you're getting on my nerves. What's a craft this size doing with a smart AI in the first place?
A post-production upgrade.
Then you're a Dark Moon construct. Argy hesitated a full half second.
I'm not at liberty to reveal that.
Olivia smiled.
You just did.
While searching for the Turaco's name and transponder code, Olivia had come across a data file identifying the owner of the craft as Dark Moon Enterprises, and that had sent her rifling through the rest of the files. Dark Moon Enterprises was a shadowy private security firm that provided threat management services to clients throughout the human-controlled portion of the galaxy. The Ferrets had tangled with the firm during a training exercise on Neos Atlantis, when a Dark Moon agent had attempted to expose the fact that the team was manned by Gamma Company Spartan 3s. The confrontation had sealed Dark Moon's place on the Oni enemy list, so it definitely seemed odd to discover the firm operating a top-secret Reap X Turaco. When the stolen faith still did not appear on the security feed, Olivia placed her thumbs on the reset switches.
Last chance, she said. 3, 2? It won't matter, Argy said. I'm system resident. I'll still be here when...
Olivia flipped the switches and actually felt happy as the cooling fans whined down, and the display screen snapped into darkness. Even if RG hadn't been a Dark Moon construct, she had a condescending personality that made Olivia want to locate the AI's data crystal and toss it into the fusion reactor. Once the Turaco systems were down, Olivia left the engineering station and started forward. So far, RG had done nothing to betray Olivia's presence aboard the craft, even when Olivia had been forced to hide in an EVA suit while a Kig-Yar inspection party sniffed around. But the AI's silence seemed as suspicious as everything else concerning the Turaco, and there was no sense taking chances. When Olivia reached the flight deck, she dropped to her hands and knees, then peered through the bottom edge of the canopy. The stolen Faith remained where it had been sitting for more than 5 hours now, surrounded by a couple hundred keepers. About three quarters were Jirohanai warriors waiting to attack the pirates they wrongly assumed to be holed up inside the vessel. But there were also dozens of keeper mechanics working from scaffolds, using laser torches to cautiously cut their way into the star sloop. Plasma torches would have been faster, but using them would have been like hitting the vessel with an artillery barrage. The spike of superheated gas would have ignited its interior atmosphere, and quite possibly triggered a catastrophic explosion. Apparently that was not a risk the keepers wanted to take with a bunch of thermonuclear warheads aboard. After a moment, Olivia spotted the source of the clang she had heard earlier. A Kig-Yar crew near the front of the star sloop had finally managed to slice a chunk out of the vessel's nano-laminate armor and open a 2x3-meter breach about where the galley should be. The edges of the hull were still smoking and glowing star-bright, but a team of Jirohanai in blue and gold battle armor stood at the front of the scaffolding, their postures tense as they waited for the opening to cool enough to risk squeezing past. That nano-laminate armor was tough stuff. It had taken the keepers almost twice as long as expected to cut through the star sloop's hull. And that was a good thing, given that the rest of the ferret team was now 4.5 hours overdue. Olivia took a moment to glance around the spaceport, studying the grotto mouths where she had last seen her teammates, but saw nothing to indicate their return was imminent. On the other hand, she found no evidence suggesting the Turaco crew would be returning anytime soon either. Olivia made a clucking sound in her throat, activating the microphone in her collar, and waited for a replying click. When none came, she looked back toward the stolen Faith. The torch crew had begun to spray water on the hot edges of the breach. It would not be long before a squad of Jirohanai entered the vessel and confirmed the deaths of the first boarding party, as well as that of Sarch and her crew. Olivia ducked back down and retreated toward the engineering station. Time was running out. She had to make contact with the rest of her team, or continue the mission alone. Chapter 10. 20:27 hours, December 13th, 2553, military calendar. Oni Sahara-class Prowler Silent Joe. Orbital approach, planet Pedoran, Shep's system. The ferret team was in trouble. Fred 104 knew that the second he entered the situation room and saw the swarm of bandits on the Silent Joe's tactical holograph. There had to be 50 designator symbols, arrayed in a triple-layer defensive sphere around the moon Terram. Stepping through the door behind Fred, Kelly 087 whistled, then spoke over Blue Team's secure TeamCom channel. "Yeah, the keepers were expecting us." "You think so?" Linda 058 asked, bringing up the rear. "This is bad. Very bad." Fred said nothing. He had been the one who'd urged Admiral Osman to continue the ferret's mission even after Sigint suggested the keepers were anticipating an Oni infiltration attempt. But he hadn't expected an entire battle fleet to be waiting when the Silent Joe arrived. Fred led the way over to the tactical holograph. Admiral Osman had been called away by other duties and was no longer aboard the Silent Joe. So he saluted the senior officer present, Captain Ewan. "You wanted to see us, sir." "I did." Ewan returned the salute, then motioned Fred and the other members of Blue Team to take a place at the holo display. "As you can see, we have problems." "I'd call them obstacles," Fred said, "and obstacles can be bypassed. especially if we move quickly.
The hint of a smile flashed across Ewan's long face, but when he spoke, his voice was stern.
I appreciate your enthusiasm, Lieutenant, but I didn't interrupt your deployment so you could give me a pep talk. Your mission has changed. In fact, it may be canceled.
Fred turned to face Ewan full on. Blue Team had already been aboard the Owl and ready to launch when the captain summoned them to the Situation Room, so he was in full Mjolnir and in no mood to stand down.
If that's a joke, sir, you need to work on your timing.
Ewan's face reddened. He thrust his arm into the holograph, penetrating the sphere of enemy symbols and nearly touching the yellow orb of Terram.
Does that look like a joke to you, Lieutenant?
It doesn't look like a reason to cancel the mission, Fred said. If this were easy, you wouldn't need Spartans.
Kelly's voice sounded inside his helmet.
You're missing his point, Fred. The Keepers aren't just prepared. They're waiting.
Yes, precisely, Linda said, also over Team Com. They know we're coming.
Even as Kelly and Linda were speaking to Fred privately, Ewan continued to address him openly.
Thanks for pointing that out. The captain's tone was sour.
I guess I wouldn't know what the hell Spartans were without you to set me straight.
You have clearly irritated your superior officer, Damon said, sharing his observation over the Spartans' team comm. Protocol dictates that you apologize.
Yes, Linda said. Do it now.
Relax, both of you, Fred hissed. I've got this.
Ewan frowned.
Got what, Spartan?
Got you, sir, Fred said quickly. I mean, I understand your concerns. You're assuming the ferrets were captured and gave up the rescue plan under interrogation.
Ewan's face softened.
It's more complicated than that.
He nodded across the holograph to Enki Hirsch, the Silent Joe's senior intelligence analyst, and said,
Play it for him.
Yes, sir.
The tiny brunette began to tap the tech pad on her forearm.
I'll bring it right up.
Bring what up? Fred asked. Still tapping, Hirsch said,
As soon as we emerged from slipspace, SIGINT downloaded the backlogged intelligence from the spy nets that Ash G-099 planted aboard the Stolen Faith.
Fred had a sinking feeling.
The Ostanalyst got them?
No,
Hirsch replied. The ferret team anticipated the gas attack and took control of the Stolen Faith, much as you predicted. But on approach to Terram, the Faith was boarded by a force of Keepers. She gave her tech pad a final tap, and an unfamiliar female voice began to issue from a ceiling speaker.
Just give me the arming codes.
The woman's voice was dry and firm.
We'll take care of the rest.
And what do we get out of it?
This voice belonged to Veda Lopez, who sounded as calm and cocky as ever.
The Stolen Faith and safe passage out of the system?
Nice try,
the Keeper woman replied. But even if I could sell it to the Dokkab, I've made my feelings clear about letting you loose, knowing the location of Salvation Base.
So what's your offer?
It was Mark G-313 who asked this.
Your lives,
the Keeper woman replied.
Unless I decide you're Oni, of course. If you're Oni, Castor is just going to rip the codes right out of you with his bare hands.
The recording stopped, and Hirsch said not all of our intercepts were that clear. But we know from an earlier exchange that Inspector Lopez claimed the Havocs on board had already been sold to the Banished. She also claimed that unless her team was allowed to make delivery, a Banished fleet would show up looking for their cargo. Fred waved his hand at the holograph.
Then that mess isn't even for us, he said. It's for the Banished.
That's the current thinking,
Captain Ewan replied. We're assuming Lopez was trying to sell a cover that would get her team onto Terram in one piece.
Makes sense, Fred said.
If the Keepers thought there was a Banished assault coming, they'd want to interrogate the people bringing it down on their heads.
Ewan nodded in agreement.
Lopez was making the best of a bad situation.
Then I don't see why you're delaying our deployment, Fred said. Everything we know so far suggests the ferrets are still alive.
That's not the only criteria.
Ewan's tone grew steely. And you know it. A soft clatter sounded behind Fred, with Kelly and Linda signaling their displeasure by deliberately making noise. He extended three fingers toward the deck, signaling them to stand down. Captain Ewan was right, and Fred did know it. Like any clandestine ops team, the ferrets were expendable. If they had gotten themselves in too deep, well, the Silent Joe was not a rescue ship, and Blue Team was not a rescue unit. Fair enough, Fred said, but Veda Lopez is the most stubborn woman I know, and she has a trio of Spartan Threes backing her up. If the ferrets are still alive, they're still on mission.
I agree, Ewan said, and I wish I could assume that.
What's standing in your way?
Sigint.
Ewan looked back across the holograph to Anki Hirsch. Anything new?
She shook her head. I'm afraid not, sir.
Then go ahead. Hirsch reached for her tactpad again.
This is from the 2020 microburst, shortly before your OWL launch was aborted.
She tapped a key, at the same time adding, It's translated from the Jirohanai. A deep, gravelly voice issued from the overhead speaker.
The gas killed them all. There are no survivors.
None, Dokab,
a second voice answered.
We searched the entire vessel. The only living thing we found are these midges.
Midges, the Dokab replied.
Let me see that.
The recording ended in a crackle. We suspect the midge was one of our spy gnats, Hirsch said. The next microburst contained several feeds that ended the same way.
So the keepers know we're listening.
Fred turned back to Captain Ewan. If that's all you're worried about,
it isn't, Ewan said, interrupting. The feeds in the previous microbursts were filled with gasps and wails. 5 hours before that, we have the same thing. About 2 minutes after the ferrets are secured for disembarking.
So you think what? Fred asked.
That the ferrets killed themselves to avoid interrogation?
I don't know what to think, Ewan admitted, but it's pretty damn clear something happened. That ship was on the pad and filled with Austanilus for 5 hours.
With no real indication that the ferrets were killed.
Or that they survived, Ewan countered.
He paused, then added, And there hasn't been an extraction signal.
That doesn't mean they're dead, Kelly said, stepping to Fred's side. Although her voice was calm and her expression hidden behind the half-bubble faceplate of her EVA Mjolnir power armor, Fred could tell by the way her lips were cocked that she was losing patience with Ewan's caution.
Sir?
Ewan's eyes flashed at the sarcasm in her final salutation, but when he spoke, his tone remained even.
You're missing the point, Spartan. We don't know whether the ferrets made it. And we have no reason to believe they've located Admiral Tuwa's family.
Kelly's shoulders came back to level.
I understand that, sir, but...
Ewan cut her off with a raised hand. But we do know that one of the Keeper's most important Dokabs is on that base, he said. In fact, we know that, as of 7 minutes ago, he was aboard the Stolen Faith.
Do you see where I'm going with this?
I am sorry, Damon said inside Fred's helmet. I know how fond you were of Inspector Lopez and her ferrets.
Fred didn't need to ask the AI to explain. Their mission had two objectives. Rescue Admiral Tuwa's family and retaliate for her assassination. The Silent Joe carried a full complement of Shiva nuclear missiles, and since the Shivas could be configured for standoff delivery against a surface target, they were clearly an efficient means of achieving the second objective.
You're going to launch against Salvation Base, Fred said.
I'm leaning toward it, Ewan replied.
But I've never been dirt side on one of these missions, so I wanted to hear from someone who's been down there tossing rocks.
I am sure we have made our opinions clear, Linda said, speaking from behind Fred and Kelly. I hope you will take them seriously.
I wouldn't have called you up here if I didn't, Ewan said.
He turned back to the tactical holograph and fell silent.
But you know how this works. The ferrets have been on the ground for 5 hours, and all our intel suggests the operation is a bust. I can't risk 120 souls on the off chance they're still alive. Hell, I couldn't do that if I knew they were.
I understand your position, Fred said. He glanced over at Kelly and Linda and used a hand code to signal them to hold fast. Then added, we all do. The color drained from Ewan's face.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
He turned to the executive officer standing at his side, then said, ready all Shivas.
Very well, sir.
She touched a button on her headset, then said, missile room, ready all Shivas. Prepare to receive targeting data. Fred waited until the executive officer had stepped over to firing control, then spoke to Ewan's back. Captain, I know you'd like to continue the mission as much as we would.
Of course.
Ewan turned around.
I may be an officer of the line, but I'm not a cold-hearted bastard.
Have you considered pinging their team comm? Ewan's eyes widened.
This is a stealth ship, Lieutenant.
I'm aware of that, Fred said. Prowlers normally avoided transmitting anything in a theater of operations, as even the slightest electronic emission could light up like a beacon on enemy sensors. But if you're going to launch the Shivas, what's there to lose? It'll be shoot and scoot anyway.
Not quite. We'll remain on station long enough to confirm strike success.
Ewan remained quiet for a moment, then looked through the tactical holograph toward Anki Hirsch.
Lieutenant, what does Sigint think?
Hirsch swallowed, then said,
we'd only need to radiate for a millisecond, sir.
But with so many enemy craft between us and the target, someone's going to hear a ping. Ewan nodded, then surprised Fred by asking, but will the enemy be able to find us? Before Hirsch could answer, the executive officer's voice rang out from firing control. Shiva's targeted, ready to launch in 20 seconds.
Thank you, Ewan replied.
5 second interval between first two. Minimum 2 minute delay with random interval for last four. The executive officer confirmed the order by repeating it, and Ewan turned back to Hirsch.
Lieutenant, will the keepers find us?
They could, Hirsch said. Every vessel detecting the transmission will have a vector on us. Once they coordinate and triangulate, they'll have a point of origin.
How long will that take?
It could take a UNSC task force about 5 seconds, Hirsch said. But UNSC systems are set up to share SIGINT automatically.
With the keepers, it's anybody's guess. The executive officer reported,
Shiva's ready to launch on your command, Captain.
Thank you, Exo. Hold status for now.
Ewan then addressed Fred.
You understand we're not in the rescue business. Even if the ferrets respond, Blue Team won't deploy unless it furthers the mission.
Understood, Fred said. That's all I'm thinking of. Ewan studied him for a moment, then said,
do I need to remind you that lying to a superior officer is a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice?
Sorry, sir. I won't let it happen again.
You'd better not. I'm putting my ship at risk on your suggestion.
Ewan looked to Hirsch and nodded.
Ping the ferret team comm, Lieutenant. Make sure they know it's us.
Hirsch's finger was already on her tactpad.
Executing now, sir.
5 seconds of silence passed before the voice of Olivia G-291 began to issue from the ceiling speakers.
Situation dark and uncertain, she said. Team has penetrated Keeper Installation Salvation Base, located in Forerunner Ruin on Moon Terram. Hostile forces have taken stolen faith and captured Havoc decoys. Ash G-099 assigned to draw off Keeper pursuit. Now absent more than 5 hours. Lopus and Mark G-313 searching for mission objectives. Also absent more than 5 hours.
Fred glanced over to find Ewan's jaw clenched and his gaze fixed on his boots. It seemed likely the captain was thinking the same thing Fred was. That the mission had indeed gone bad. And Olivia was about to be on the receiving end of 500,000 Shivas.
After a momentary pause, Olivia continued, "Transmitting from captured Turaco. No identification or transponder code. Equipped with uncooperative smart AI RG and upper..."
There was no pop, scratch, or squeal. Olivia's voice simply ended, leaving an ominous silence. Hirsch jabbed at her tactpad for a second, then said, "The transmission was cut off."
"By what?" Ewan demanded. Hirsch continued to study her tactpad. "My guess is the Turaco's AI," she said. "There was no background roar or signal pulse, so I don't think it was an explosion or a comm malfunction." "Which is why Olivia made a point of saying the AI was uncooperative," Kelly said. "She knew it was going to cut her off."
"And I think that is not all she was telling us," Linda said. "Why would she remind us that Terram is a moon?" Ewan furrowed his brow.
"What's your point, Spartan?" "That a good soldier does not waste words during a sit-rep."
"And why did she say the situation was dark and uncertain?" Kelly asked.
"What's a dark situation anyway?"
"Dark moon," Damon said. "Spartan G291 is using a redundancy code. There is an 83.3% chance that she is trying to tell us that Dark Moon Enterprises is involved."
Fred considered the AI's suggestion.
All he really knew about Dark Moon was that they weren't afraid to tangle with Oni, a trait that made them either foolish or fearless, and probably both. But it didn't make them terrorists. They wouldn't assassinate a UNSC admiral and abduct her family just to infuriate Oni. And they wouldn't align themselves with the keepers of the One Freedom unless there was something in it for them. After a moment, he spoke aloud. "Damon thinks she's trying to tell us Dark Moon is behind this."
"I didn't say behind," Damon said. "I said involved."
Fred ignored the AI and asked Ewan, "You know what Dark Moon is, right?"
"No contact, no access," Ewan said, quoting the UNSC blacklist order.
"I read the Fleetcom bulletins, Lieutenant."
"So I imagine you see it," Fred said. "The ferrets tangled with Dark Moon during their training. And now Livy is using a redundancy code to tell us Dark Moon is mixed up in this mess."
"Mixed up how?" Fred hesitated, reminding himself that no matter how much he liked Lopez, it was his duty to be honest. Finally, he said, "That's hard to say for sure. But if she knew for certain that Dark Moon was directly responsible for what happened to the Tuas, she would have found a way to let us know."
"She would not have said uncooperative AI," Linda said. "She would have said hostile AI."
Ewan looked away for a moment, then said,
"Very well. You know your fellow Spartans better than I do. So that will be our working assumption."
As the captain spoke, the tactical holograph began to bleed designator symbols in the Silent Joe's direction. And Hirsch said, "Captain, the Keeper fleet has triangulated our position. We need to relocate." "Which will require loading new navigation data into the Shiva guidance systems," the executive officer said. "If we're going to attack, recommend launching the first pair now."
"Negative," Ewan said. "Stand down all Shivas. We are continuing the original mission as planned."
"We are?" Hirsch was clearly astonished.
"But, sir, they know we're here."
"And the Silent Joe is a stealth craft, with a mission to complete." Ewan turned back to Fred. "Return Blue Team to the Owl, and stand by for orders." Fred was happy to obey, but a bit surprised. The conservative response would be to order Olivia to evacuate and launch the Shivas.
"We're going to insert?"
"Affirmative. If Dark Moon is involved in this, we need to know why and how," he said. "I'm adding a third objective to Blue Team's mission. Recover the Turaco."
"Very good, sir," Fred said. "What about Lopez and the missing ferrets?"
Ewan smiled. "Well, you're going to be down there anyway. It wouldn't hurt to figure out what happened to them."
Chapter 11. 1509 hours, December 13th, 2553, military calendar. Salvation Base. Moon Terum, Pedoran Planetary System. Shaps System. Across what Ash G-099 had come to think of as the pop-up lake, the Keeper assault fleet was vanishing one vessel at a time. One second, a war surplus Seraph or a captured longsword would be standing in the blue-green water, the gentle waves lapping at its struts. And the next second, it would be gone. Whether the vessels were launching or sinking was impossible to say. They always vanished while Ash was looking in another direction, and when he looked back, there would be nothing to indicate what had become of them. No residual glow, no whirlpools or pressure circles on the surface of the lake. It was as though the craft had never existed in the first place. Had Ash been anywhere but a forerunner ruin, he would have assumed that his smoothers had worn off and that he was beginning to hallucinate. As it was, he merely told himself to observe and adjust. The quantum technology of Forerunner devices was about 100 grades above his training tier, and any attempt to impose his own concept of time and space on what he was seeing would only add to his confusion and frustration. A soft rustle began to fill the corridor behind him, the sound of his pursuers closing in from both directions. Ash remained where he was, kneeling just inside the mouth of a cliffside grotto, and continued to look out over the lake. There were no other living beings in sight, not even Olivia or the Keeper ground crews, but the rolling water filled him with a deep sense of calm and belonging. He felt the cosmos pulsing in his heart and saw his thoughts flashing from star to star, and when he inhaled, it was the breath of the universe that filled his lungs. He wanted to stay in the Forerunner caves forever, at one with all things everywhere, bathed in their eternal, infinite harmony. But his team was counting on him to maintain the diversion. Ash switched his gaze to the Turaco, searching for some indication that Olivia and the other ferrets had made it aboard. The lake seemed to prevent the observation of living beings, at least from the grotto where Ash was kneeling. So all he could do was look for indirect evidence of their presence. He didn't find any, which he decided was a good sign. The ferrets were too well trained to unintentionally leave a trail, so anything he could see from his perch would suggest trouble. The situation at the Stolen Faith was more disturbing. According to the chronometer he had taken off a dead Keeper, the ferrets had departed the Kigyar transport only a quarter hour earlier. But already the star sloop was surrounded by towers of scaffolding that should have taken at least twice that long to erect. And just a moment earlier, a dark rectangle that looked like a breach had appeared in the vessel's hull, up near the galley. The team hadn't expected that to happen for a couple of hours. It certainly didn't feel like hours had passed. It barely felt like 15 minutes. Ash rose and turned toward the arched doorway that led into the corridor, then made a cluck to activate the microphone sewn into his collar. He had done the same thing many times since entering the grotto complex. This time was no different. No response. The rustling in the corridor fell silent, and a Jirohanai voice sounded outside the doorway, from a few meters down the passage.
"You are a bold and gifted fighter, infidel."
An electronic undertone suggested he was speaking through a translation disc.
"It will be a sadness to kill you."
"No worries," Ash said. "You won't." The Jirohanai chuckled.
"Not if you yield now."
"Surrender?" Ash leveled his weapons, a spike rifle and a plasma pistol, at the doorway. "That's not going to happen."
"I give you time to reconsider," the Jirohanai said. "There has been too much killing already."
"I'm sure you think so." Ash's tone was mocking, but in truth, he felt the same way. He had taken out 8 pursuers so far, 3 of them Jirohanai, and each time he had felt a stabbing pain beneath his heart
as though he were wounding himself by slaying his enemies. It was not a feeling he had ever suffered before, and he suspected it was related to the sense of peace and oneness he had begun to experience